Hello, and welcome to the HR Means Business podcast, which is part of the HR Happy Hour Network. I'm your host, Mervyn Dinnan, and today I'm going to be talking to somebody about a topic that I think is hugely important. Certainly one of the biggest topics, I think, on the HR agenda in recent years has been diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I'm delighted today to be able to welcome to HR Means Business, Paul Modley, who's the Managing Director for Diversity, Equity and Inclusion for AMS. Paul, welcome to the show. And would you like to introduce yourself and tell listeners a little bit about your role?
Thank you, Mervyn, and delighted to be with you today. So, yes, thank you for the intro. You kind of introduced me there. I'm responsible for diversity, equity, and inclusion across the AMS business. I sit within our innovation function. And I wear two hats. I'm responsible for what we are doing internally as a business across our 10,000 workforce, making sure that we continue to deliver an inclusive culture and a sense of belonging for our colleagues. I also have an external hat as well in terms of making sure that when we are working with our outsourcing clients, that we are amplifying diversity, equity and inclusion when we support those clients. And I've been doing this specific role for about 3 years now. My background is predominantly in TA. I've worked in-house for organizations like Barclays, EY. Latterly, I've worked on the London 2012 Olympics and Paralympics when it was obviously in London in 2012. And I got involved in that right at the beginning. And that's really where my interest in diversity, equity and inclusion developed to the point now where I'm obviously driving that for AMS's business.
And tell listeners a little bit about AMS, who they are and what it is they do.
So we are a global talent acquisition, outsourcing and advisory business. We typically work with large corporate organizations to support them around their talent acquisition challenges or their services. So we work with a range of organizations across different sectors, including the likes of Barclays, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Deloitte, public sector across the UK. And from an outsourcing perspective, typically we're working with those organizations on long-term contracts, and they are outsourcing parts of their TA functions or the entire thing, and we will work with them to deliver the service against there. From an advisory perspective, we're then working with organizations to help them if they've got a specific challenge that they're facing in TA. They may need some kind of tech advisory support, they may need some assessment support, or they may need some DEI advisory support. So we can support our clients around a range of different services.
You said that you first became interested, or I think DE&I was highlighted to you when you were working on London 2012, mm-hmm. which I, in fact, I actually was interacting with you at that time.
You were, yeah.
I was transitioning to what I do now from a company that was helping to supply people to you. In terms of DE&I, how do you move it up the corporate agenda? I mean, you personally have got the internal at AMS. You're talking to clients as well. What are the kind of conversations that you need to have initially?
So I think the key requirement for this is to have senior leader commitment and buy-in from the top. Certainly, we had that at London 2012. With our CEO at the time, Paul Dighton, and our chair, Sebastian Coe. They totally got it. They totally understood the role that diversity, equity, and inclusion would play in delivering a fantastic games experience, not just for the athletes, but also the spectators and all the other different stakeholders. I also have that support here at AMS, in that I work really closely with our CEO, David Lee, and our chair, Rosaline Blair, and they support me and drive the organization around our strategy. So that senior level commitment, board commitment, is really important to make sure that we are kind of moving in the right direction. The organization then as a whole really understands why it's important. They can see that sort of senior level commitment And then you can move forward. Where that doesn't exist, you know, you might have some brilliant sort of diversity, equity, inclusion teams in a business, but they're not getting that buy-in from senior leaders, then it's really difficult to move forward. It's really difficult to kind of achieve the success that that you want.
How do you deliver value from DE&I initiatives? I mean, that presumably is part of the conversation that you'll be having with people. So what are your, I suppose, views on that?
I think ultimately it's about, you know, the why we do this in AMS is to kind of support our people, support our culture as an organization. We are a people-based business, and it's really important for us to be able to attract people in all of the countries where we operate, and kind of, you know, we're looking for different talent. We're looking to tap into underrepresented talent. And so for us, value is really about being able to hire the people that we need in our business and to attract the diversity of thought in our business, and thinking about it from all levels of diversity, whether it be age, gender, race, sexual orientation, social mobility, etc. That for us is really important, and that enables our business to grow. So that's the value that we as an organization get from DEI. So that's from an internal perspective, that will enable us to continue to grow, and it'll enable us to continue to kind of work with clients on their agenda as well. So it's less about kind of proving value through sort of hard numbers. You know, when I'm asking for investment in programs or heads, it's really about, right, so the impact on the business is going to be that we'll continue to acquire the talent we'll need. We'll continue to be able to stand out through our EVP, and we'll be able to continue to develop and work with different clients because we are seen to be the leader in the way that we're managing our own DEI programs.
When you're speaking to clients, is this are they already aligned with what they need to do, or do you find yourself having to possibly with them kind of go through the value that is derived and kind of why they need to bring this approach into the organization?
Listen, I think on the whole, when we are engaging with clients, so for the first time, might be through a tender process, a bid process, it typically DEI is in the sort of top three, top five of the challenges that they're facing or the things that they want to address through this new sort of relationship. Now, it's fair to say that organizations are on different parts of the journey. Some organizations are really advanced in the way that they're thinking, the way that they are taking DEI forward. And then there are other organizations who are at different levels, you know, a little bit behind, smaller organizations or medium-sized organizations, maybe just don't have that sort of investment, or, you know, they're not where they need to be. So I think it really depends on the sector, it depends on the region, it depends on the size of the organization. And I guess we're able to adapt the conversation that we have depending on that situation.
Now, one of the things that I'm keen to talk to you about are employee resource groups. Now, I was involved with a piece of research earlier in the year that was primarily US, but also included UK and some other countries. And one of the findings was that employee resource groups, whilst being very influential, certainly in the US and some places, didn't seem so influential in the UK. There was not such a great adoption of them. So I know from conversations we've had in the past that employee resource groups are an important way to help embed the DE&I agenda. So I wonder if you could, I suppose, tell listeners a little bit about what are employee resource groups and what is the value they give?
Yeah, so as you know, I'm a big advocate of employee resource groups, and something that, you know, we're really proud, and I'll talk a little bit more of the work that we have been doing within AMS. But essentially, employee resource groups are community groups which are typically aligned to a diversity trait where members of that community come together and allies as well. So it's not just they're not closed to a particular group, but they also and it's really important they interact with allies to really take that agenda forward. So we have eight employee resource groups within AMS. They're global employee resource groups, and they aligned to the kind of typical areas that you would expect: gender, ethnicity, disability, neurodiversity, social mobility, veteran, LGBTQ, and essentially these employee resource groups are led by individuals in the business. In AMS, they are volunteers, so they step up and take responsibility for leading our ERGs on top of the their day-to-day responsibilities. And they have the support of an ExCo member as well, and some budget as well to kind of take their plans forward. And what we have found within AMS is that they have been a massive enabler for helping us to take forward and drive our inclusive culture in the business. Particularly, I would say, our Black employee network and our Juntos Podemos employee network, which is aligned to Hispanic. So those two groups in particular have really helped us to advance the work that we're doing around ethnicity, race, equity across our organization. And they've essentially become critical friends of the business. So as well as creating these community groups where people come together to learn, to have some fun, to kind of really challenge the business's thinking, we utilize these groups to help us to, you know, when we're doing comms, when we're doing new business initiatives, when we're rolling out new training, is to kind of get these groups to kind of work with us around these different initiatives, just to make sure that we're kind of being thoughtful, we're bringing diversity of thought into the things that we are rolling out. So that kind of that criticality, the business critical friends has become really important, and certainly they've got the ear of the CEO, the chair. We invite them into we have quarterly DEI board meetings with our CEO and chair, and we invite our employee resource groups in so they can feed in directly to our DEI board, as well as our corporate board as well. And they talk directly to our non-exec directors around, you know, the challenges that we're facing from a sort of diversity perspective. So yeah, they are incredibly important to us. They're a brilliant enabler, as I say, for continuing to build and drive on our inclusive culture. And I would say, just before I hand back to you, we see a brilliant adoption across our UK business. We've never had any challenges in our UK business to kind of support and get people involved. And we see that across all of our regions where we operate as well.
For people listening to this who think we don't do this in our organization, how do you get started? Who I suppose owns the initial initiative? Who kind of takes responsibility for them?
Yeah, so it kind of started organically for us, probably. Whilst we relaunched them formally about 18 months ago, I would say it started organically about 6 years ago, where our first group was set up, and it was the LGBTQ employee resource group. It wasn't called an employee resource group then, but it was a kind of few individuals in the business who said, look, I think we as a business need to really think about our focus around LGBT inclusion, and they came to me because whilst I wasn't sitting within a formal D&I role then, I kind of nominally was the person that people came to if they wanted to talk about sort of D&I initiatives across the business. And I said, look, if you're interested in formulating a group, then do it, and I will support, but it's really important that this is led by, there's employee kind of buy-in to this. It shouldn't be led by sort of senior leaders. It shouldn't be imposed on the business. It needs to come from the business. And that's how it started with our LGBT group about 6 years ago. And as I say, it developed into us formally launching the employee resource groups 18 months ago. And I think the key ingredients is there needs to be a kind of a demand from the business. Colleagues need to kind of get behind it. There needs to be executive support. So you need to have a sponsor, a business sponsor, to really help that group with formulating their goals, their objectives, etc. And hopefully some budget behind it as well. And you know, so we have put a little bit of budget behind our ERGs so that they can deliver against their plans.
And is this, do people tend to meet almost like, I suppose, a special interest group in an organisation? Or is this done more kind of, I suppose, in the flow of work, shall we say?
So most, of, in fact, all of them will have kind of formal governance structures. I say governance lightly, you know, not to make it too formal, but yeah, they do have meetings. They have monthly meetings. They have, you know, they've got plans. They've got their sort of annual goals that they're working towards. We have a what we call a milestone calendar of events that we work towards. So each of the employee resource groups will have one or two milestone moments in the year that they are kind of working towards. So for example, you know, we just had a busy quarter. We had Pride in June, which is obviously a big celebration, a big milestone moment for our LGBT group. So a lot of planning went behind that in terms of events that we were running, marches that we were supporting. And then in July, we had Disability Pride. Many people won't know about Disability Pride, but it's a movement really to support, you know, disability inclusion. And again, our disability ERG were very busy in the sort of months running up to that to kind of get our events and activities behind that. So yeah, we're quite formal in the way that we operate, so that the groups are very much aligned and supporting the business, and obviously they've got that sort of senior leader support to help them move forward as well and kind of break down any challenges or barriers that may exist.
And in terms of, I suppose, from the business's viewpoint, do you have specific individuals within ERG who you identify as running them, or as from what you've said, it sounds more kind of not committee, but more kind of a group. So
yeah,
it
we
could
do
be
have,
anybody. Yeah,
we do have specific leads, but they could be any level within the organization. I've got, if I look at our ERGs, we've got a real mix. We've got some kind of, you know, people at lower levels of the career ladder, yeah. And then more senior people. I guess the important ingredient is that kind of commitment to that particular ERG. And it doesn't matter whether, you know, you're at a lower level or a senior level, you know, as long as you've got that kind of commitment, you've got that interest, then you can take the lead. And obviously I work with those ERGs to support them as well from a central perspective to ensure that they've got that support coming through from my team as well.
How do you incentivize them? So, I mean, you mentioned before about having some budget for the initiatives that they want to do, but in terms of the individuals who get involved, how do you incentivize them? How do people get rewarded? Other than you know the satisfaction of what they're doing for colleagues.
Yeah, it's a really good question and a very topical question for us because it's something that we are looking at. So within AMS, we make sure that if they're making time to do this, that they are being recognised through their sort of performance management process. So it's not being seen as, right, it's just side of desk activity, that there is value in it. So, you know, and that's why it's important that their line manager's brought in and support them. We're kind of looking to move into the next iteration of that in terms of how do we formalize that a little bit more so that one of the ideas that I've talked to some of our clients about and heard some of our clients are doing is that, you know, if they are making time to be a leader, that it's formally built into their job description. So if they're a kind of, a recruiter and they're aligned to a client, well, 10%, at least 10% of their job description has to talk about the role of the leader of that ERG. So that's something that we're looking at. The other thing that I know some organizations are doing is paying additional salary, if you like, for the role that they're doing within the ERG. So That's not something that we are committed to at the moment, but it's something that we're definitely looking at as well, just in terms of the conversations I'm having externally, just to understand how widespread that is.
Yeah, I guess you need to have some kind of structure, because otherwise, if it's a kind of a volunteering thing, then it's you don't really get any structure around it.
Yeah.
And you need something, not formal, but I suppose something more
you do.
Planned. So if people are listening to this thinking, you know what, this would be a great idea in our organization. You've mentioned obviously a number of the different groups from LGBTQ, you know, age and et cetera. How would some say HR get started? Because it's not, you know, you don't go to the board and say we need employee resource groups. So what are the opening conversations and who are they with?
I think what you'll find is that there's probably things. So if people are feeling like we don't have these groups in operation, well, there's probably things going on across the business already that HR may not be aware of. I think the important thing is to open up the comms channels and really start talking to colleagues in the business about, like, we're thinking about sort of establishing employee resource groups. What do you think? You know, this is what. This is why we think, you know, it'd be a good idea to do them. But, you know, it's really important that, you know, our colleagues buy into that. So I think it's opening up the comms and engagement channels, positioning what employee resource groups are, how they operate, the fact that they need to be employee led. And if there's anybody interested in the business who'd like to kind of take something forward, this, you know, to start having those conversations and really start it small. It doesn't need to be too formal. I think, you know, start these things organically, and they will evolve and build and have some structure, obviously, to kind of support them, but don't overcomplicate it to start with. I think it's just really start to build and allow colleagues to come together and start having conversations, whether it be about race, whether it be about gender, whether it be about neurodiversity or whatever, veterans, you know, just allow colleagues to start having conversations. And it's really interesting how these things start to evolve.
And in terms of leaders, I can think, I suppose, earlier in my career of one or two organizations where I've worked, where I wouldn't say there's formalized what we're discussing now and what we're describing now, but you know, smaller groups where senior people in the organization might drop in for a few minutes and say, this is good, and then completely forget about it. So in terms of getting that support and buy-in, is it a case of working slowly to, I suppose, show the value, or is there something else that people can do to maybe get more leadership support?
I think you've got to, like with all these things, Murphy, you're not going to get every leader on board at the same time with the same level of commitment. And I think you've got to kind of choose your leaders who you know are initially who are more committed. They may have a particular lived experience or more aligned, you know, to a group for whatever reason. And I think, you know, choosing to get those leaders involved to start with, getting their commitment. And I think other leaders will look in and think, all right, well, you know, I want to kind of, you know, if they're kind of getting involved and driving this, and maybe I need to step up and do my thing. And I think that kind of healthy competition definitely helps. It helped for us in the Olympics, where I think we did some really interesting things very early on. If you think about sort of 2012, well, I was there 2007 to 2012. We really drove that competition across our directors in terms of their diversity hiring. So it almost became a, you know, bit of a competition. We were a sport-based organization, so we wanted to introduce some competition. So, you know, they all took responsibility then for hiring underrepresented talent and kind of making sure that they were not at the bottom of the leader table. And I think it's the same thing really about getting leaders involved in sort of the ERG activity. You know, you won't get everybody involved straight away, but I think generally it'll create some level of interest across all of them.
Okay, I suppose as a final question, Paul, how do you see in terms of I suppose the future, in terms of how the ERGs within your organization have developed, how do you see this I suppose developing in the future?
I think there's a couple of things. I think we've done a really good job at kind of getting our ERG set up and driving their agendas. What we want to move them into as a next step is that kind of intersectional thinking. So kind of getting groups together, thinking about specific issues that may impact, for example, female, black, disabled kind of communities, how you kind of bring that together and think about what does that mean? What are the issues that that specific community are facing? I think that's where it gets really interesting. And we're starting to see that with our groups coming together. For example, during Pride, we had our LGBT community talking about mental health challenges facing that community. So that move to more of an intersectional approach, I think, is important. And then I think the other important point is, you know, we do a good job, I think, it's kind of regionalizing our ERGs as well, because you can't just have a global approach to this because every region is different. So how we look at LGBTQ is a good example. How we look at that from a UK perspective compared to, say, Poland, compared to China, compared to the US, you know, it's really different and the challenges are very different. And so kind of setting up our ERGs with the right regional support behind those issues is really important. And, you know, I think we do a good job there. We've got more thinking to do there. Take that forward.
Okay. And if people listening to this want to get in touch with you, maybe find out a bit more, how can people connect with you?
So always really happy. And I certainly get a lot out of talking to peers in my network. So people can contact me through LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter, Threads, all the social channels, but very happy for people to contact me directly here at AMS as well.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you lots of luck in the future.
Great. Thank you so much, Mervyn.